I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Back in 1962, at a critical moment in the civil rights movement, James Baldwin wrote an open letter to his nephew and namesake about how to love himself and others while living in a country determined to oppress and denigrate him. Almost 60 years later, our guest Imani Perry has written a book to her two sons, Breathe, in the tradition of James Baldwin. The title comes from Eric Garner's dying words when New York City police had him in a chokehold when he repeatedly said, "I can't breathe." Imani Perry tells her sons, Freeman and Issa, mothering black boys in America, that is a special calling, something her mother said. She shares stories about her own life growing up in Alabama, her hopes and fears for her sons, living in a country that views black boys and black men with suspicion and fear, even hatred. Imani Perry joins us on Radio Time. She has been a guest on the show talking about previous books, including most recently Looking for Lorraine, about Lorraine Hansberry. She's a professor of African-American Studies at Princeton University. Imani Perry, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Let's begin at the very beginning of your book.
Okay. Between me and these others who utter the sentence, the indelicate assertion hangs midair. Without hesitation, they speculate as if it is a statement of fact. I look into their wide eyes. I see them hungry for my suffering, or crude with sympathy, or grateful they are not in such a circumstance. Sometimes they are even curious. It makes my blood boil, my mind furnace hot. I seldom answer a word. I am indignant at their pitying eyes. I do not want to be their emotional spectacle. I want them to admit that you are people. Black boys, people. This fact, simple as it is, shouldn't linger on the surface. It should penetrate. It often doesn't. Not in this country, anyway. But no matter how many say so, my sons, you are not a problem. Mothering you is not a problem. It is a gift.
And you say a vast one, a breathing one, beautiful, and you go on from there. What sparked this book? Was there a particular incident or the fact that your sons are now teenagers?
Well, it's interesting. What sparked it was actually my editor, Gayatri Patnaik at Beacon, who is wonderful, who noticed that I am constantly talking about my children, whether it's social media or in conversation, and really they shape so much of what I do. They're a guiding force for my intellectual work, for my political work. And so she said, "Is this something that you'd be interested in doing?" And I said, "Yes," although part of what happened is, you know, usually when I post on Facebook or something about my kids, it's humorous, right, and it's playful. But when I had the opportunity to reflect on the depth of this task of stewarding young people into the world to be their own people in the context of the United States, it turned more sober. It made me very reflective. And it made me want to be in a tradition of people who have had these kinds of meditations. And so,
like James Baldwin?
Yeah, like James Baldwin and W.E.B. Du Bois, who, for whom the beginning of the book is really an homage to his question that he talks about people asking him, how does it feel to be a problem? To which he answered seldom a word. And it's, you know, this is a recurring theme, right? And wanting to be very clear that they are not a problem. The society in which they live is a problem in many ways, but my children are not problems.
There is a sentence you say, everybody and their mother and father say, it must be terrifying to raise a black boy in America.
Yes.
That's the sentence.
That's the sentence, yeah.
That angers you,
it
frightens
does.
You, all
at the same
all those
time.
Emotions.
Yeah, and it really provokes a resentment, and I needed to reflect on why that was. There's something that happens. There's a slippage where people go from this recognition that there's been a lot of political activism in Black Lives Matter to insisting upon, right, the recognition of the dangers that face black children, period, and in some way, particular ways, black boys. From that recognition to sort of a fixation on their existence as problematic. And it was very important to me to refuse that, right, to insist upon the magic and beauty and joy that is involved in rearing them, notwithstanding the circumstances, and actually the kind of humanity that develops in the face of those circumstances that has a potential, I think, to shape the country in some profound ways. So,
I was thinking as I was reading the book, well, what if Imani Perry had two daughters?
Yes.
I mean, what if, would she write this book? Would it be a different book?
You know, I reflect on that. And in some ways, it might be different. But I don't think dramatically so, whether I had daughters or whether I had genderqueer children or non-binary children. I think, in fact, part of what happens for me, it happened for me in the process of writing, was to think about, well, how do I raise boys to have, given the, you know, the expectations of patriarchy and sexism and masculinity in the society, how do I raise boys to fully witness me, to recognize me deeply as a human being, right? And not
as
just
their
as
mom.
Their caretaker, but yeah, and others, right? And so, you know, to not sort of raise them to sort of desire all of the things that patriarchy expects of them, right, to be, you know, big and strong and prominent and domineering and overbearing, but actually to be deeply sensitive to other human beings. And that, I think, is something that is a message for all of us and not but has a particular valence when raising young men.
You tell a short history of Sojourner Truth.
Mm-hmm.
The abolitionist, her son Peter, is sold.
Yes.
And she sues for his return.
Yes.
Which I think, as you write, sort of raises this history of black parents or black mothers losing their children. They're stolen. They're
yes.
sold. They're imprisoned.
Yes.
They're killed.
All of the above. And I wanted to draw on that history, and also in the midst of drawing in that history, draw attention to the current realities that confront black children and undocumented children, and primarily Latinx, currently being separated from their parents. This is a repetition of some of the ugliest parts of American history, and there's an urgency to responding to it. And I wanted to use my history and my fears as a mother, as a lens for thinking broadly about what it means to try to care in a context that is often quite violent.
You also describe that, you know, your children are growing up middle
yes.
class.
Yes.
As you say, more white than black in terms of their interactions with the larger world.
Well, at least at school.
At yeah. school, yes. yeah. But yeah. you also say police do not cruise your neighborhood. You will not be harassed every day.
Yes. And I think that's an important distinction because, I've written about this before, I'm always concerned that as a black person who is relatively privileged and has some financial security vis-a-vis other black people, that and who writes, that my experience will be overrepresented, right? And treated as overrepresentative. And so I wanted to be transparent that my children do not receive the full force of white supremacy by virtue of their relative class privilege, which does not mean they don't experience racism on a regular basis, but it's important. I want them to not, I want them to be able to recognize the depth of unfairness and inequality that is not just self-involved, right, but that to be able to read through their experience and have it shape their ethics in the world at large. Mm-hmm. And so that's part of it. And I think for all of us, actually, that's the lesson we have to embrace.
It's always, I mean, so hard to talk about all this stuff, but it's so hard to talk about class.
Yeah.
I mean, because it is, it's so amorphous.
It's amorphous, and yet it is, you know, it's bludgeoning, right, in so many ways. So it's clear that, you know, even middle class or relatively affluent African Americans by virtue of income have very, very, very limited wealth vis-a-vis their white counterparts, right? So if we talk about class as wealth, overwhelmingly black people are not middle class, including me, right? But you know, class emerges in other ways, education, access, you know, the kind of neighborhoods you live in, all those sorts of things. And I think that's important to acknowledge. And we need a conversation about it that does not separate class mm-hmm. from race and ethnicity and language and immigration status. All these things operate simultaneously. And I think part of why it's hard to talk about, because we try to talk about it in isolation, and it's never in isolation.
As you say, I mean, class exists, but I'm assuming for your boys, your teenage boys, when they're outside of their neighborhood, when they're in Center City, Philadelphia,
yes.
they're viewed like other black boys,
oh,
black
absolutely.
Teenage boys.
Without question. And, you know, part of kind of socializing them is through an understanding of that reality. When they were very small, I used to say, if you're ever without me and you're in a crisis situation, find an elderly black woman to try to protect you. I mean, really, like, sort of at a practical level, like thinking, who in the world can you depend on? Who in the world can you trust, given, you know, the vulnerability that they experience?
I remember when my son was a teenager many, many years ago, and he was complaining. He was in a store with some friends, and they were being followed, you know, by security. And I remember saying to him, well, now you know how black teenagers feel.
Every day, yeah.
I mean, for him, it was this sort of out of the ordinary, as a white boy, a completely out of the ordinary experience. But at that moment, you know, he was a suspect.
Right. And the thing, I think the other thing is, for black people, one doesn't outgrow that. So that, you know, as adults, as old, we still experience that kind of suspicion and skepticism and hostility. One of the things I wrote years ago was that the value of a dollar in black hands is reduced by virtue of the experience of shopping and how often it's unpleasant. And I think that's really, I think that's something that I want people to recognize in reading the book. I want, you know, I want people to see, and I want my children to understand. But again, I want that to translate into a larger interpretation or understanding of what is happening in the society, you know, to go from the very specific to the broader questions.
You toggle back and forth between your own childhood growing up in Alabama and also some time in Chicago.
And Massachusetts, too. Yeah.
Yeah, you lived in several places. But you also talk about having a teacher, as you say, a brilliant teacher for white students, but one who seemed to single you out for, frankly, harassment.
Yes, and it was me, and it was other black students as well, and it went on for the majority of his tenure. At a certain point, the curriculum was changed to include writers of color, and he you know, threw one of the books on the floor and said, "I'm not going to teach this." Right, and that is the distinctions in terms of treatment. And all kinds of institutions is actually one of the most pernicious forms, I think, of kind of interpersonal racism. Because what happens is that it demands that white people who would not otherwise join along with that necessarily become complicit.
Right? With their silence.
With their silence or with their adoration of the person who is being overtly hostile, right? And so you wind up experiencing this extreme isolation in these moments when you say, well, this person is my friend, this person is my friend, and yet they are complicit with my, not just mistreatment, but humiliation frequently.
Almost up in a rake here, the bystander effect.
Yes,
right?
Absolutely.
When people stand by and let things happen, they do become complicit.
Absolutely, yeah.
Let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Imani Perry is our guest. She's got a brand new book. It's called Breathe, A Letter to My Sons. And she has teenage sons, a 13-year-old and a 16-year-old. And she teaches African-American studies at Princeton University. We're going to hear more from the book, more readings as well. You can join us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscone, again talking with Imani Perry about her new book, Breathe, A Letter to My Sons. Let me just read an email from Cynthia, and then we'll get another reading from your book. She says, the words from your author's book ring so true to me. As the mother of two black boys, now ages 18 and 21, I've also tried to instill in them the truth about their relevance, beauty, and how vital they are to our society, despite how vilified they are. Raising them, especially as a single mother, has been both my greatest challenge and my sincere honor. I mean, in many ways, you say this in different kinds of words, but you say the same
Absolutely.
Thing in your book.
Yeah, I so appreciate that comment, because I think the joyful part is often left out in these discussions, and it is absolutely essential. Yeah.
In fact, let me have you read another section from your book.
Sure. You are gifted with something, and it is important. You have seen black men of every stripe, of every sort, for the entirety of your life. Famous and homeless, athlete, intellectual, musician, teacher, businessman, public servant, fast food worker. Seen, and I do not mean simply knowing who they are, I mean hearing their stories. The range of dispositions and tones of laughter. Accents and nationalities and drawls and swagger and awkwardness, hypermasculine and elegantly feminine and every variation in between, a common thread, a dramatic assortment, and you are members of this collaged confederacy which, as a through line through all manner of circumstance, can share the Marvin Gaye refrain, makes me want to holler the way they do my life, makes me want to holler, throw up both my hands.
And again, that's Imani Perry reading from her new book. I'm curious, I'm assuming your sons have read this book? Yes,
they
no?
They have read portions of it. I was saying, actually, at a book talk the other day, I have been writing them letters all of their life. So some of this is repetition of the personal letters I've written them. And it's also, a lot of it is our sort of kitchen table conversation. So they know everything in here, although they have, I don't think they've either of them has read the entire thing straight through.
Do you worry about their response?
I do. I mean,
it's very personal.
It's very personal. I gave them veto power over the stories. So there are many things that I wanted to put in the book that they insisted I take out, which I think is fair. And I guess not worry so much as wanting to make sure that they feel the space in the world to narrate their own lives, however that is appropriate, that it doesn't become sort of overbearing. And so that's both telling them that, but also they really are both really beautiful writers. So I do hope that they write their stories in one way or another. But yeah, but that I think
no
is
pressure.
A concern. No pressure. Yeah.
This is, I think, something that all parents struggle with, but maybe it's even more challenging for parents of color,
mm-hmm.
which is that about what you tell a young child about the injustice in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But as you say, no one understands fairness as much as a young child,
and that is
absolutely true. But there's always that, how much do you protect? Mm-hmm. How much do you give them a real reality check about this is the world that you're going to be, that you are living in?
Yeah, both I and their father and the extended family, we err on the side of telling the truth. At all points. I mean, from the time they're very small. Because I think what happens if you don't tell the truth, then it's very easy for children to internalize the logic of the world, right? So we know that small children have been socialized into race at a very, very young age. They see it. And they see the differences in neighborhoods. They see, inequality is so apparent, right? What people have or don't have. And so as a consequence, I did not want them to internalize messages of inferiority or reduce, less important. And I didn't, and I also didn't want them to think of themselves as different and them somehow superior to other black people because they have more resources. So for me, the answer was to talk it through from a very small age. But I understand that. I understand why there are other parents for whom make different kinds of decisions.
Right. Yeah. Just wanting to preserve a kind of a childhood for
a
child.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You say at the age of five, you protested, carrying a sign that said, "Stop the War Against Black America."
Yeah.
Where were you and what was the protest
I was actually
about?
Even younger. So it was a protest about police brutality on the steps of the Birmingham Public Library, City Hall. Someone will probably correct me after this hears about
this
which
is
one.
Birmingham, Alabama.
This is in Birmingham, Alabama with my parents and my aunt. So part of what I'm doing in the way that I'm rearing children is standing in a tradition that I was, I was raised by organizers, by activists. And my grandmother was not an activist, but she was someone who's very clear in her discussions about race and inequality. And I felt like, this was a responsibility for a young age. It didn't feel like a burden. It really did feel like something righteous and beautiful to fight for. And so I hope that's translated to my children.
You say you grew up in an an unexceptional, exceptional working class black family.
Yes, right. So my grandmother, who, and I say this without any hesitation, is the smartest person I ever knew.
What'd you call her?
Madea. Which is a classic Southern term for mothers or grandmothers, and it's an abbreviation of Mother Dear. Some people know it from the Tyler Perry films, but it actually has a much broader, complex
texture.
That's
where I went, I get it.
She is a woman who did not finish high school. She left and got married and had 12 children and cleaned homes and raised 12 children who all went to college, many of whom were valedictorians or salutatorians. And then eventually wound up working in respiratory therapy, but, you know, really inculcated this incredible sense of self-regard, and personal value in the context of Jim Crow Alabama. Right. And that, in some ways I feel like my life mission is to do or try to be who she would have been had the circumstances of her life been different.
You describe being, maybe I can't remember if it was your first or second son, but being with her, the baby's crying, tired.
That's Issa, my second son.
Yeah, and in many ways, but she has these open arms and she takes your son and settles him within
immediately.
Moments. Yeah.
Immediately. She just says, he's fretful. Give it to me. Right. And and she was frail at that moment. Right. That's the same woman. The temperature of the bath was always perfect. The morning grits, perfect texture. I mean, who just had such an incredible attentiveness to each child.
Wow.
With all those children. Because, over 20 grandchildren and 12, just remarkable. Yeah.
And her kitchen was where I guess the action was.
Yes.
As a kid growing up.
Yeah, yeah. And for all of us, really, because the adults would gather there at night and the kids would gather there in the morning. And her life was a constant meditation, constant in prayer. She cleaned all day, every day, because there's so many people in the house, and tended to. And I think part of what made her so extraordinary is just unbelievable resourcefulness. So she knew how to get access to resources in the most, not the most oppressive of circumstances, but certainly extraordinarily oppressive circumstances.
And that's Imani Perry talking about her grandmother, who appears in her book, A Letter to Her Two Sons, to Imani Perry's two sons. The book is called Breathe, and our guest is a professor of African American Studies at Princeton University. You can join our conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499, especially if what we're talking about resonates with you. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY. Radio Times. One of the stories that you tell in this book is about calling the police.
Yes.
And telling, I believe it's your older son, essentially, go to your room, lock the door, because you were afraid the police might think that
he was an intruder.
That he was an intruder.
Absolutely. Yeah. It was, and what was, in retrospect, what was both alarming and I think probably quite ordinary in the minds of many black adults, parents, caretakers, and the like, is that I was more afraid of the police than the prospective intruder. And I was thankful that he had a cell phone. Thankfully there wasn't an intruder, but that feeling, and we've heard countless stories, people who are having psychiatric breakdowns, people are in crisis, who are, when the police are called as a source of help, wind up dead, right? That is a terrifying prospect, and it's a recognition that that there is not the sense of there's not a common sense that the police are there to protect us or as a source of safety.
There is this famous talk that black parents have to, I guess, both of them, all their children.
They should have I think it's more common with boys, but I think girls are absolutely under similar threat. I have some ambivalent feelings about it, I must admit, because I think there's a way in which, and it's very human, that we try to convince ourselves that it's possible to protect our children. Mm. That if we tell them all the right things to do and say that, danger won't come. And we have abundant evidence that that's simply not true. And it's interesting. A lot of the organizing around gender and feminism has actually moved me on this issue because, you know, I was also a person who was like, you know, you don't want to walk alone at night in terms of gender safety. And a lot of the conversation over the past several decades in feminist circles has been, wait a minute, we need to be focused on and directing our attention to those who would attack, as opposed to self, you know, this self protection that really doesn't work. And I think it's very similar for Black people. So, sure, I tell my children to be respectful all the time to adults. Right. Period, but I don't think that lesson will keep them safe.
I think it's true that women are more at risk at home than on the street.
Right. I think it depends on you know, I think it depends where you are and in who you are. You know, so like, you know, I think. For sex workers or for trans women or for women who do a lot of low-wage work, the street is also very – but at any rate, I think, you know, the point that, you know, you need to acknowledge that we actually have to deal with our vulnerability as simply a fact and not something that we can manipulate ourselves out of. And it's incredibly difficult and painful to confront that fact.
I want to have you read another section from the book. This mm-hmm. is about white people.
Mm-hmm.
On page 6869.
I have taught you not to love white people. That sentence may get me in trouble. Of course you love individual white people. I do too, many in fact. But I have taught you to not love them as a group, because whiteness as such means hating oneself. And I have taught you to love Black people. Of course there are individual Black people that you dislike or even despise. I do too. There are Black people I dislike so much I don't want to lay eyes on them. But loving Black people is not about each individual. It is about something bigger than that. Yusuf Kumanyaka has a poem called Blackberries. In the middle, it goes like this. Although I could smell old lime-covered history at 10, I'd still hold out my hands, and berries fell into them. Eating from one and filling a half gallon with the other, I ate the mythology and dreamt of pies and cobbler. We hold open our hands for certain histories. We do make choices about what we will swallow and dream.
Hmm. That's such a, as you said, it may get you in trouble.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I read that over several times. And obviously, as a white person, I tried to not to take it personally.
Yeah.
And I don't think I should.
No, it's not personal.
Right, right.
Because whiteness is not about, it's in fact, not about individuals at all. It's about a system and it's about an idea of human beings. And we can see it simply by virtue of the shifting categories of who counted as white in American history, right? Where groups are sort of moved into whiteness when they become beneficiaries of the full benefits of citizenship, right? So that whiteness is not about individuals. It's about a structure and a system. And Blackness, in fact, isn't about individuals either. Hmm. It's about a standing, in many ways, about standing outside of the dominant order and trying to create some sense of self in the face of it. So when I say I've taught you not to love whiteness, I don't want my children to fall in love with the system that has marked them as inferior. You can love any individual with whom you feel a spirit connection, but not the system that marks you as inferior.
Because whiteness as such means hating oneself.
Yes, absolutely. You know, I think the process of confronting the discomfort with that reality is actually how we get towards, you know, it's so funny because people oftentimes when you bring up race, people will say, oh, you know, let's just think about individuals, don't focus on race. But this is actually what it requires. A confrontation with what whiteness means is what is required to even get to like a real honest reckoning with each other as individuals.
This is that conversation that we say we should be having that we never
yes.
seem to have.
It's so
You're
hard.
Trying to get us closer to
yeah.
this, Imani Perry.
Yeah, and it's hard. And it's hard.
It is hard.
Yeah, it's hard because, you know, this is true for Americans across the board. And I say this over and over again, and I borrow it from James Baldwin, Americans are addicted to innocence. And so the anxiety that is provoked whenever anyone, and I think it really across the board, is that, you know, there's something about how you identify yourself that is where you are implicated in the suffering of others. people don't like that. People run away from it. People respond defensively, right? And that's along the lines of race, gender, sexuality, gender identity, immigration status, all of these things, right? So my thought is, okay, so my own example of that, right? So I'm a black woman with disabilities, so I could think I'm not, of course, but I'm implicated in the suffering of others because of my class, because of being a citizen, right? I think every day, how is it that we actually go forward each and every day like life is normal when there are children, babies being snatched away from their parents? Like, so we all have to get away from that desire for constant innocence. Yeah.
That's such a profound thing. That, I mean, James Baldwin said so many things.
So many things.
Yeah, but
so
that one is truly just sort of breathtaking.
Mm-hmm.
But you also write the next page, here's a confession. Recently, I've wondered if white people are irredeemable.
Yeah. And that was a difficult thing to write. But I just, you know, and I think I've actually said this to you before, you know, my rage when Trump was elected was in part because, you know, my mother grew up in a white nationalist state.
This is
Alabama. And now she has to be back there again after a life. And I just, you know, in the 1619 Project, for example, I mean, we've literally 400 years of struggling. I just don't know what else there is to do. And maybe, I am constantly sort of like, well, is this something to sort of give up on? Do we need to just get up and go to some other part of the world? Because all the death, all of the struggle, every form, you know, writing, law, protest, rebellion, you know, you can't think of something that hasn't been done, the building of institutions, of schools, of organizations. And now the backlash that is really in so many ways, it's like an antebellum sensibility, right? And that he's still a viable candidate to win re-election. So it's astounding to me, and it's devastating.
Let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Imani Perry, our guest on Radio Times today. She's a professor of African American Studies at Princeton University. She's been a guest on Radio Times numerous times, often talking about her latest book. And her latest book is called Breathe, A Letter to My Sons, written in that tradition of James Baldwin, talking about loving yourself when a country doesn't necessarily love you back. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Do stay with us. Much more after the short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Imani Perry. I'd love to have you read another section from your book.
Okay. People say that white people did not think black people were fully human during slavery. And sometimes they still say that today. I have never believed that was true. Having studied the law of slavery, it is very clear to me that in the antebellum period, white people knew black people were absolutely human. They were not chattel, but they were to be treated as chattel, social chimeras fashioned from the Frankensteins of European law. To be treated as other than human when you are human is not a mistake or a flaw. It is a sin without excuse. I know that something had to be rotten in the heart of anyone who stripped and beat and raped and stole children and broke hearts with impunity and entitlement. I can see it when I encounter such evil today.
Seems to me, I mean, that's such an important distinction,
mm-hmm.
that white people who owned black people saw them as people, which made their brutality even more brutal.
Absolutely. And you know, perhaps the most, you know, heartbreaking evidence of it is that the vast majority of African Americans have a substantial amount of European ancestry, which is a consequence of slavery, not more recent, you know, interracial intimacy. And so, you know, one of the things that I think is important, because I'll say it this way. We always talk about, well, don't be critical. That person is a person. That was a man of his time. Well, Trump is a man of his time, too. right? Or, you know, all of these, or, you know, Timothy McVeigh is a man of his time. You know, Dylan Roof is a man of his time. What does that mean, right? And so just because certain kinds of violence and cruelty may be excused socially doesn't mean that we don't look at them critically. And I think to the extent that the point of history is why we teach it, right, is as a current social tool, that means that we have to look critically in order to imagine our present and our future, right? So if it's constantly making excuses, then we're not actually using history to do something meaningful for us today.
I remember going to Auschwitz, and as a not Jewish person, married to a Jewish person, but I'm not Jewish myself, and when you're in that part of the world, saying to myself, and I don't know the answer to this, what would I do? I mean, would I hide a Jewish family in my basement or in my closet?
Yeah.
I don't know the answer to that.
And I think we need to be honest that that is a feeling that most of us would have to grapple with. It's very easy to pretend that we would be the heroes of history. But the reality is just not the...
Unless you're tested, right?
Right. Unless you're tested. And you're willing, you know, to be quite honest, unless you're willing to risk your entire life, right?
You mentioned 1619, the 1619 Project of the New York Times, marking the 400 years that enslaved people were brought to this country. And reparations, of course, is one of the remedies, I guess, that has been offered. What do you think about that?
I support reparations. I've always supported reparations. I mean, really, and my first encounter with reparations talk was actually as a child. So there's recent energy, but there's, you know, this has been a discussion for many generations. My concern, and I've been very pointed about this, is that, you know, reparations is insufficient. It may be necessary, but it's insufficient because the way that we know racial inequality works, it often produces disaccumulation because Black people are valued less. Property that is in places where Black people are is valued less. Right? All of these systems and all of the inequality that we see in education and jobs and promotion and will likely kind of reinstitute an economic inequality not soon after reparations. So the idea for me is that, okay, yes, reparations, but that doesn't address that. That by implication, if done by itself, suggests that all of the inequality is the past, as opposed to the fact that it is, and I wrote a book about this, that, you know, that it is constantly being reproduced. And so that has to be addressed as well.
And the idea, I guess, of reparations, sort of being able to wash
your hands
and say, okay, we dealt with it and now we can move on.
Right. That's just simply not true.
Let me read a couple of comments. One from Oni: I have interracial grandchildren and I don't use words Black or white with them. And I'm wondering your guest thoughts on this.
It's hard to know. I mean, I'm not sure why the question. I'm not sure why they don't use those words. I don't think that there's anything wrong with the words. I think what's wrong is the uses to which those words have been put. And then, you know, but they also, we organize our society in large part around those words. So by avoiding them, you don't change that they will shape their lives, right? I mean, that's just a fact. And so I am always inclined to give kids tools to critically engage the way that they are seen or treated or the way the world is organized. So I think more language, more speech, more discussion is always better.
Be curious what the grandchildren want.
Yeah, that would
and
be,
how,
yeah.
And
it
they
probably will change.
See themselves.
I mean, it's likely to, you know, because people, you know, especially when you're coming of age, your views change and grow. And so, yeah.
A comment from Terry: I'm so glad to hear your guest using her rage to make her point. I felt this rage as a white mother, so I can't imagine what she feels.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I really appreciate that. And I've experienced several book talks already. There is a resonance with white mothers, with other non-Black mothers, right? And I think that's important. Because some of these things are universal, certain kinds of fears, especially about their future, especially now, right? It is important to experience that emotional resonance in order for us to move. And I think it's also, there's something pretty universal about mothers being very self-critical and blaming themselves for everything and constantly thinking they're failing, right? And as a consequence, we actually take on the burden of a lot of the ills of the society. I think it's part of our gender culture. And so I like hearing that too, because I want us to shift that energy from self-blame to social transformation.
Women are so quick to say, I'm sorry.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You asked your son, your older son, Freeman, you know, what is something I like to do?
Yeah.
And he didn't have an answer.
No.
Which I thought was very revealing about perhaps not just you, but just as parents, we don't often let our children know about the things that give us joy.
And for me, you know, he was young at that point, and I was devastated. And then I thought, that I think was a failure on my part, because you have to, you know, part of rearing children is you have to train them to be ethical in their relationships with human beings. And so as parents, we have to give them the opportunity to empathize with us, to care about it, all those sorts of things, you know. And so it changed my parenting practice.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I really thought, okay, I really have to make them know what's important to me, what I love, what I enjoy, because I want them to be curious about those things with everybody in their lives as part of caring for people.
Was it a matter of just hiding it from them, or you just weren't including them?
Yeah, I think it's just, you know, the day in and day out, and you do things for kids and you care for kids and you talk to them about and you ask them about their feelings and about their days, and but you don't say, oh, this happened and made me really sad, or this was exciting, or I loved, you know. It's really is actually like giving them the credit for being the full human beings they are also, you know. Yeah, the dynamic relationship.
So what do you like to do?
Oh, gosh. Well, obviously read.
Yes, I know. Right. Lifelong reader, right?
Lifelong reader. You know, and I love music. They knew that, because we have a sort of, they've had a music-filled life. And rain and the beach and, you know, Limeade and all those sorts
crochet.
Of things. Yeah, crochet. Oh, I love to crochet. My aunt taught me how to crochet. And a lot of that, too, is my grandmother really taught me to relish small pleasures. And that is something that I'm trying to impart with my children, too, because so often we get caught up in the big things that we want. But so much of what's good about life is these small, beautiful moments. Oftentimes it can be of our own creation, you know, laughter,
sure.
And like our favorite treat or things like that. And so I think that's worth remembering. Well, one of my, so Rita Marley, Bob Marley's widow, in her memoir, she says, and it's one of my favorite quotes, she says, everything important that ever happened in her life wasn't planned. And I just thought, oh, right, that's really true for most of us, right?
And yet we plan.
Right, yeah, we try.
Well, let's do one more reading, okay. And this is on page, for those people following along, page 123.
Okay. Boys must know about hurt. Boys do know about hurt. They know these things. They do these things, but they also endure them and suppress them so much that they forget. The time for unearthing is always now. Witness your beloved. Sit with your own hurt. I have to say this explicitly because I recognize my own hypocrisy at work. I have always wanted you to be deeper and wider than the scope of prescribed masculinity. But I bought you the toys and clothes prescribed for boys from the outset. The one exception was a baby boy doll who wore a green jumpsuit. I bought him because I wanted you to learn to nurture. But other than that, it was trucks and blocks and Legos, maps and globes. So I worry that I must tell you about tendernesses that perhaps you could have seen for yourself had I set things before you differently.
And again, that's our guest, Imani Perry, reading from her new book, Breathe. Again, a paragraph that I very much resonated with,
yeah.
About just making assumptions.
Yeah. I mean, the intensity with which we gender kids, and people make fun of the parents who are very overtly like, say, I'm not going to gender my child. But they're on to something, because even if you don't go fully into ungendering, we need to be thoughtful about, because part of what happens, and I think about this a lot as the mother of boys, and having my cousin's children who I'm close to as well. You know, we rear boys in this hyper-masculine fashion, and then we are surprised when they become hyper-masculine people, and then we punish them for it, right? And so we project a lot of what we, you know, a lot of what is our own responsibility. And so I think we, all of us, need to sort of really be deliberate about thinking about, well, what kind of human beings do we want to bring into the world? And then think about, what do we put before them? What options we allow them? How do we nurture them from the outside if we want really deeply kind and good and ethical people across the board who are not shaped by gender in ways that are abusive and violent and, you know. But I love Legos, though, and all that kind of stuff. Those toys are great.
And trucks,
yeah.
trucks are
great,
good.
Too.
Okay,
but it's just it's a way that I think it's less. I think those toys are awesome, and I love them, and I had them, too. But it's also, like, what does it say that so much of the nurturing and the reading and the cuddling is feminized, you know, for children? I just think it's.
Boys need cuddling.
Yes, and I have cuddly children. So. Well, at least my younger son is very cuddly. So.
An email from Dave. Does your guest have any hope or optimism in the future of our society?
Yeah. It's funny. I think, and I keep saying this, I think hope is an ethical responsibility for parents. When you bring people in the world, then you have to put, and not just hope, but put your energy, direct your energy towards hope. Right, that's what we have to do for them. So I think I'm responsible to be hopeful. I have many moments of feeling hopeless, but I think it's a discipline, it's a muscle, right? To look for where the possibility lies. Mm. When I was growing up, my mother used to say, you know, the point she used to say reflectively as she was raising me, you know, black parents have to raise their children as if the society is free, but also with the recognition that it is not. And I think, you know, in some ways that is, you know, that was one of the best parenting lessons I could possibly get from the way that my mother parented. And so that's, you know, it's the work towards freedom.
An email from Sakina says, thank you for this topic. I'm a Muslim mother who wears a hijab, and I have two boys, and I found that I had to have the talk with them because of their skin color and religion. That is when I fully understood what a black mother goes through. These are sad times.
They are. And I think I appreciate that, too, because, you know, I understand, and I think it's important to point out that there is a particularity to blackness in the society, but it is not by any means the only mode by which people are marginalized or abused or mistreated, right? And to the extent that, you know, that I want to draw attention to this particular dynamic, is I also, as a companion with that, I want it to be geared towards thinking about these issues broadly and finding connection across different social locations and being able to witness each other. Yeah.
You were talking about hope. I mean, it's important to have hope. And I wonder about faith.
Yeah.
How does that figure in, or does it?
Well, you know, it's so funny. Several of my colleagues talk about how I have an Emersonian relationship to faith because I just take what I need from whatever tradition. I think faith is incredibly important, and my name means faith.
Iman.
Yes, and so that was inculcated early on. But I think it's important actually for a host of reasons. One, you have to believe in the righteousness of your causes, right? And for me, those are, you know, love and justice and inclusion, right? The things that we always talk about. But also faith in that is essential to have intimacy with other human beings. You know, you have to have faith in the prospect of deep intimacy. And I think that happens in lots. It happens in romantic relationships and friendships and familial relationships. And that is the cornerstone, right, of all of this, right? And so I think faith is incredibly important and also difficult. And we need to acknowledge both.
Well, we're going to end on that note. Imani Perry, thank you so much,
well,
as always,
you.
For
thank
joining
you for
us
having me.
On Radio Times. You're very welcome. And again, her new book is called Breathe, A Letter to My Sons. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Charlie Kyer is our engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show is produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.